I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 22nd of January. This hour of the program, Net Neutrality. You assume that when you go on the internet, you can go to whatever website you would like. You can go there whenever you'd like to go there. You can use any feature, watch online videos, listen to podcasts, search the internet, do emailing, instant messaging. You can attach devices. Network neutrality makes all of that possible, but net neutrality is dead for now due to last week's ruling by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. They handed down a decision regarding net neutrality, which we're going to talk about this hour of the program. Susan Crawford is our guest. She is still waiting for her fiber optic service. She's a visiting professor in intellectual property at Harvard Law School, author of Captive Audience, the Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age, and she's a contributor to Bloomberg View and Wired. She served as special assistant to the president for science technology, and she co-led the FCC transition team between the Bush and Obama administrations. She teaches internet law and communications law, and last year she was on Time Magazine's Tech 40, the most influential minds in tech. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Susan Crawford. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And she wrote an op-ed piece in Newsday titled Why Net Neutrality Matters to You. Susan Crawford, hello. Thanks so much for being with us again.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. 10 years ago, you wrote in your piece, the FCC wandered off the reservation and away from 100 years of communications history. What did they do?
Well, what happened 10 years ago is that Michael Powell, who's now the head of the Cable Trade Association in Washington, said that, and at that time, the chairman of the FCC said that competition would protect Americans and that old-fashioned regulation was no longer necessary when it came to high-speed internet access. And that turns out to have been a mistake, because in the 10 years since then, we've seen great consolidation in high-speed internet access provision and no oversight. So now we have the worst of all worlds.
And you are still waiting for your fiber optic service.
Yes.
I remember that conversation.
Story. Well, and it gets richer, because on the day this D.C. Circuit opinion came down, that morning I was standing in my living room here in Cambridge. I just moved here to get high-speed internet access service, and my Comcast installer was there. And I said, just meekly, I said, well, are there any choices in this building? Does it have to be Comcast? And he said, oh, yeah, we signed an exclusive agreement with the mayor of Cambridge. No competitors coming here. And it just went on and on. He gave me so much material, and he was a great guy, and he fixed my service. So I hope he doesn't get in trouble. But he really told me what the reality is, which is that Comcast assumes no competition here in Cambridge with all these universities sitting here.
And you say that's true for 77% of people who use the internet, right?
Yes. For people who have a wired or fixed high-speed internet access connection at their home, for 77% of those people, their only choice is their local cable monopoly. And years ago, in something they called the Summer of Love, 1997, the cable operators divided up the country among themselves, so they never enter each other's territories. And the big ones, like Comcast and Time Warner Cable, also pay a lot less for pay TV programming than a smaller operator might. So now anybody hoping to compete with these guys would have to enter two markets at once, both the market for programming, where they'd pay a lot more, and they'd have to build a new data market, data network in that market. So they are very confident, these actors, that they face neither oversight nor competition, and they're reaping enormous rewards.
Last time we talked about their profits, and I reiterated that conversation many times since, the profits are astronomically high, aren't they?
Yeah, one of the analysts on Wall Street called these businesses almost laughably profitable, because it's a 97% margin on these services for Comcast. They're just coining money. They've made their investments, and they're in harvesting mode. Now, they did invest a lot of money, but that was a while ago, and they've built out, and they're done. So all they're doing now is charging everybody involved more, steadily more, for their services, and they have no incentive to improve those services, say, to fiber to the home.
Mm-hmm. So what does last week's court decision, U.S. Court of Appeals for D.C., what does their decision concerning net neutrality mean for the Internet, mean for all of us?
Well, again, we're talking about Internet access, not about content per se. This is about whether or not the FCC, as a traditional communications infrastructure regulator, has authority to tell those providers of high-speed Internet access what to do. So 10 years ago, the FCC, led by Powell, slapped this label on high-speed Internet access of basically an unregulated service. And then recently, Mr. Obama promised that net neutrality, or the idea that these providers should not pick and choose among sources of content when they're transmitting our Internet sessions, Mr. Obama promised that net neutrality was important to his administration, and so the FCC issued what it called an open Internet order back in December 2010. What the D.C. Circuit has said is that you can't deregulate with one hand and then regulate with the other. You can't have it both ways. If you're going to impose what amount to non-discrimination rules, like old-fashioned rules to which the telephone companies were subject on high-speed Internet access, you're going to have to label these services the right way, call them Title II services is the nickname for it, or, you know, traditional telecommunication services, in order to have that power. So now that the FCC has painted itself into this box with its labeling regime 10 years ago, it can't at the same time issue the open Internet order, and it's really stuck. Unless the FCC reclassifies, that is, slaps the right label on high-speed Internet access, it's going to be left having no power at all when it comes to what has become an essential facility for Americans, just like the railroads were for farmers in the 1890s.
Well, that's going to make a lot of people upset. The possible ramifications of this are such that most consumers, I think, would be pretty upset about what could happen. How do you get the FCC to have power over this?
Well, yet this is a purely administrative matter that does have power to just relabel these services. It's administrative classification. Legally, it's absolutely clear they could do it. And, in fact, the D.C. Circuit's opinion seems to be very strongly pointing them in that reclassification direction. The problem here is political, and this is where people could help. What the FCC is undoubtedly worried about is that if it even mentioned that it was considering reclassification, Michael Powell, now the head of the Cable Association, has said this will be World War III, that the cable operators and the telephone operators will march on Capitol Hill and get Congress to gut the FCC's budget and make life miserable for the commission.
Wow.
And make life miserable for the administration. And from my perspective, look, you know, you're getting killed. Does it matter if you are hung or shot or drawn and quartered? You know, you're not making any friends, FCC, by not reclassifying. So you might as well have some principles and take this step so that America can be on a better economic footing in the global competition.
Mm-hmm. And the cable companies, the suit was filed by Verizon.
Yeah.
What are they looking for? What do they want?
Well, Verizon is actually mostly at this point a wireless carrier. That's where most of its revenues come from. And what Verizon and AT&T and the cable companies all want is the ability to charge both subscribers whatever they want, but also any content provider seeking to reach a subscriber. So let's say Wisconsin Public Radio is on the Internet and using up a lot of capacity. Let's say you want to provide a telemedicine piece of programming or something like that that uses up a lot of bits. The idea is that they want to be able to charge you for the privilege of reaching subscribers. They want to have what they call a two-sided network where they can make more money from both sides of the network, both the people seeking to reach subscribers and the subscribers themselves.
So they're in it for the money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This isn't evil. This is just natural profit-seeking behavior. They have this sunk cost, which they've spent on infrastructure. It's subject to no oversight by the government and no competition. So now the next step is just to, you know, turn the wheel so that they can make more money from the same infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Well, last time we talked with you is about cable charges. This sounds somewhat similar to what cable companies are doing to me. Is it?
It's very similar. So, in fact, that's the right mental model to have in mind, that this essentially turns data services into one giant pay TV system where only some sources of content can reach you, and it's all very expensive and it's very bundled. You know, after all, the cable pipe is just one undifferentiated, you know, flow of water. You can think of it that way. Some of it labeled internet access, and the vast majority of it labeled pay TV services.
Right.
So if, and in essence, the cable TV distributors are competing against the popularity of the internet, and if they make it so that nobody has a choice and so that they can charge for preferred access to subscribers over their internet connections, then their other pay TV-like services become much more, you know, delightful for consumers. And as it is, more than 90% of Americans who subscribe to high-speed internet access also subscribe to pay TV. It's one bundle. So it's in the cable operator's interest to drive ever more revenue to the places where they can charge partners and affiliates for the privilege of doing business.
Well, how much more money does it cost these providers to give information? You're using up so much space on the internet. If you use one service more space than another, how much does it even cost them to provide that? Anything?
It really doesn't cost them anything. It's about, let's say, a penny per gigabyte of data to get delivered from the cable head end to you. It really costs nothing. But that doesn't matter. They're not charging us based on their costs. There's no inquiry into what their costs are. This is just, they've got this built-in infrastructure which reaches 93% of Americans, and they're just going to charge whatever they can. And so far, Americans just keep paying.
Mm. So they would charge, you wouldn't get a bill for it, they would charge the people who are giving the information who would pass along the cost?
Right. So in the end, so this is might be good for very rich content providers, like even a Facebook, that can afford whatever it is that AT&T and Verizon charge them. It would be bad for smaller operators providing content to all of us. But in the end, all of these costs get passed on to consumers. It's consumers and American businesses and ultimately the country's competitive position that gets harmed.
So has there been a bit of an uproar about this, Susan?
To the extent Americans ever focus on telecommunications policy, I think this might be one of the moments. You know, it's in the interest of the very few operators in this country, there are about five of them, to make this slightly confusing and a hard story for Americans to grasp onto and get angry about. We're the frog being boiled. We don't quite wake up. But there is a kerfuffle. There's an uproar here because there's a moment when the FCC is really put to its choice. Is it going to let these services just act as if they're newspapers, you know, free speech
right.
actors?
Yeah.
Or is it going to say, no, this is essential infrastructure. It needs to be labeled the right way. We need to assert authority over it. And by the way, America should be in the lead when it comes to high-speed internet access infrastructure. As it is, we're pretty much drifting towards the middle of the cap. Of the pack, behind a whole bunch of other developed countries.
Mm-hmm. So let me get this right. The FCC could change the way they do this just by deciding they were going to change this. They would take a vote?
Yeah, and they, you know, the Democrats have, this shouldn't be a party-driven decision, but the two Republicans have already announced they're against reclassification. So the Democrats have three commissioners, Republicans have two, they take a vote, they reclassify, they're done. But the problem is the firestorm, the World War III,
right.
the campaign contributions. The telecommunications industry leads the nation in campaign contributions. You know, AT&T gives more money than Goldman Sachs.
Really?
Yeah. So,
oh, my goodness.
And they're very deeply connected in each state. They're large employers. They give a lot of money to nonprofit organizations. They're very powerful politically. So they could make life miserable for all kinds of actors in politics in America if the FCC moves a muscle towards this reclassification.
Well, I was wondering about nonprofits. They could make nonprofits' lives even more miserable by not allowing them to have as much access to the internet as, say, a place like Facebook, couldn't they?
They could. I guess I was talking about a different issue, which is wielding political influence
yes.
by giving money.
Right, I understand that.
To the pet causes.
But you give with one hand and you take with the other.
Sure. And the problem is that no one quite understands this issue, which is the current state of affairs. They get away with murder.
We welcome phone calls. Is it more than a little kerfuffle for you? Are you upset about this? Do you understand what's going on? If not completely, because it has been made somewhat difficult to understand, but some of it is pretty obvious. Susan Crawford has the answer. She's a visiting professor in intellectual property at Harvard Law School, and she is the author of an absolutely captivating and important book, Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. She teaches internet law, communications law. She was special assistant to the president for science, technology, and innovation policy, and co-led the FCC transition team between the Bush and Obama administration. Here is how you reach us for your questions, for your comments, for your concerns. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can reach us on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, a staff of 15 reporters and editors in a bustling newsroom could be a scene anywhere in the country at the San Quentin News. All of those journalists are inmates, and their target audience is fellow prisoners in California's penal system. We'll be talking about the newspaper, which really is quite well done. Hour two of our program. All right, let's go to phone calls. Peter in Stoughton, our first caller for you, Susan. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon. I consider this decision very similar to the Citizens United decision as handed down by the Supreme Court. It's going to rock the internet forever, and as was pointed out, the chances of things being changed is remote just because of the power of money in all the wrong places. I heard a proponent of this decision on some program the other day, and he was going on, well, this will improve the competition between the internet carriers and we'll all get better service because of it. Well, if they really want to improve the level of competition, they can compete for my money by offering me faster internet. As was pointed out, we have much faster internet in other countries. Instead of trying to find ways to legislate the money out of my pocket, why don't they just provide me with better service? And finally, I'm wondering what the international implications of this are going to be. Does this mean that ISPs from overseas will get throttled down when they're moving data to the United States or from the United States? How is that all going to work out?
Thank you, Peter.
Well, that's all very interesting, Peter. I appreciate that. And good you bring up Citizens United, because one of the arguments strongly made by Comcast and Time Warner Cable and Verizon is that they are indeed First Amendment speakers because they retain the right to edit the internet. And they made that argument in front of the D.C. Circuit, and I assure you they will continue to make it because their point is what they really want to do is remove any constitutional authority from the Congress to say anything about high-speed internet access, to make it impossible to legislate in this area, because anything that Congress did would be subject to a presumption of unconstitutionality, as if Congress was censoring Comcast's and Time Warner Cable's speech by making rules in this economic area. So you're absolutely right. This is very similar to Citizens United, sort of the speechification of what are very different kinds of questions. And in the context of high-speed internet access, it's really about commerce. This is about the United States' ability to communicate. I was also very interested by your last point. What effect might this have on people from other countries trying to reach us with their traffic? Well, I am confident that we'll see the same kinds of, they're called interconnection battles at the edges of AT&T's and Verizon's and Time Warner Cable's network with all networks that we're seeing now, that there's no incentive to stop that. In fact, the FCC is not trying to stop that. If there's only one railroad line to your farm, let's put it that way, you are dependent on that railroad line for your communication with the outside world and for the price at which you can, charge for your own products. If the only way for an ISP from England to reach you is to go through Time Warner Cable, Time Warner Cable can act as a tollkeeper and raise the rates of interconnection. And they can do it very incrementally, very slowly, but it makes life more difficult for traffic all around the world to flow. Well, this is all part of the same story.
Doesn't this make businesses, many of them in America, upset because they can't be competitive players?
Right, and I just got back from a trip to Stockholm where they pay a 19th of what I pay.
Wow.
For a service that's much better. And, it's just sort of unthinkable how much better life is in particularly South Korea, Sweden, Japan, soon New Zealand, and several other countries for high-speed internet access than it is here. So, yes, I would think American businesses would say, why are we paying rents to these private companies for the privilege of communicating? You know, this is exactly what happened with electrification, that in the 30s, a lot of America did not have electricity service, and that's because it was being controlled by private trusts. And it took the leadership of FDR and Congress to overturn this state of affairs, and it took years, it took decades. But eventually we got there to the point where we now assume the presence of electricity. Well, in Sweden and Japan and South Korea, they assume the presence of unlimited communications capacity mm-hmm. for a very reasonable price, and we don't, and that's a drag on the entire economy.
Thank you, Peter, for the call. We go to Greg in Madison. Hello.
Thanks, Kathleen. I came in early, but things are happening so fast. You know, maybe I missed it when I didn't hear a direct answer to your question whether she'd gotten a high-speed fiber link, an optical fiber link. What I heard is she got a Comcast high-speed. So is relabeling just about the ability of the companies to declare something that's not state-of-the-art fast? And why would that set off World War III? The use of metaphors here. I'm just trying to get basic and understand. Your guest a moment ago said no one understands this. Do you explain it to me like I'm a five-year-old?
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate the question. So, no, I have not gotten fiber optic service. In fact, nobody in Cambridge can buy a commercial fiber optic link to their home because the cable operator here, which is Comcast, is serving all of Cambridge, and Verizon and nobody else has been given the right to do that by the town. What I'm talking about in terms of relabeling is very fundamental. It's the idea that the FCC has any authority to tell high-speed internet access providers what to do, what standard to build to, whether to open their networks so that other people can compete using those networks. All of that at the moment is off the table. So if the FCC today said, we think it's a good idea for fiber to the home to reach all Americans, and here's the standard, and here's what we should build, they have no authority to do that, because they have the wrong label attached to the service of high-speed internet access. So, yes, these questions tie deeply together, and they all stem from policy. The private market is not bringing us fiber-to-the-home access because the cable operators have, by and large, controlled those markets in America.
Thank you, Greg, for your call. Stephen, on email, if advertisers are going to plug up our internet bandwidth with unwanted ads, shouldn't the advertisers pay for our internet connection? Same with cable TV. We pay for cable TV, and then we pay again with our attention watching their unwanted ads. There's as much advertising on cable TV as there is on free TV.
Well, you should think of high-speed internet access as the current replacement for the former two-way general-purpose network that was the telephone. It's not a broadcast network. It actually was established so that anybody could communicate online without having to ask permission of a central gatekeeper. And that openness, just like the openness of the telephone, has given rise to enormous economic growth and great social and cultural developments all around the world. So actually, those advertisers, so maybe you're thinking of Google in this instance, they have paid for internet access. They've paid for it on their end. And you, the subscriber, have paid for it on your end. And the problem is that the access gatekeepers here, Comcast, Time Warner, can stand in the middle of that relationship and assess their own rates unconstrained by either oversight or competition on both sides of that market.
You know, I remember, Susan, when this whole debate was happening in the city of Milwaukee, it seems like quite a few years ago, about granting control to one cable operator. Well, you know, they've got to lay all the lines. They're going to put all this money into this. But there were a few people at that time who said, yeah, aren't we eventually going to worry about what lack of competition will do? And lo and behold, we can't think beyond tomorrow, can we? Because the exact thing that people were worried about at that time has surfaced.
Right. And what's so interesting about Stockholm is that they did think beyond tomorrow. 20 years ago, they installed what's called a dark fiber network, which means that it's like a street grid. The fiber doesn't have lasers in it. It's just the blank, neutral infrastructure. And so the city put out a bond and installed that blank, neutral fiber infrastructure throughout Stockholm. So 20 years later, there are now many retail providers of fiber to the home. The private market in access is flourishing, and nobody can control that basic street grid, the fiber infrastructure at the very bottom, because the city has it. It's never going to be bought out by private equity. So that's really long-term thinking. And, you know, the Nixon White House wanted to separate out the cable operators' control over their transmission from their control over programming, because they saw the built-in conflict of interest that would otherwise be created, and they couldn't get, the Nixon White House could not get Congress to go along with them, and gave up. So every once in a while we have a spurt of long-term thinking. We did it with the telephone, we did it with electricity, and it's now time to do that with fiber access and high-speed internet access in America.
Candy in Lake Mills. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Hi, Candy.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. And yesterday there was a show on, and it was Tom Ashbrook, and a lady called in. It was the same subject. And she asked, how, as consumers, can we influence this decision that's being made, and how, what can we do to stop this momentum in this decision? And then how do you think we move towards the model that you see in Stockholm? What can we do as consumers, or is there any groups that I can join? Because I just feel this is so bad. This is just really bad, and we need to stop this.
Thanks so much for the question. So there are a couple of groups in Washington that are doing their best to influence the debate, and you should take a look at their sites. And, they're looking for members and looking for help. Free Press is one of them. Another is Public Knowledge. But on the local level, you can do a lot to become a Stockholm. That wholesale network I talked about in Stockholm was actually the third network in the city. They already had a telephone network and a cable network, but the city fathers decided, and it was both conservative and far-left people who decided this, that it would make sense to have that wholesale neutral infrastructure in place. They built a third network, and they said, we'll rip up the streets just once, and then we'll have all of this competition. We'll have choices. We'll never be stuck. So your mayor, wherever you are, can call for the building of this dark fiber neutral infrastructure in the streets and say, yes, we're going to rip up the streets, but we're going to do it once, and as a result, we'll have choice. But the mayor needs political air cover. The mayor needs support, and the mayor needs expertise. So whatever you can do to make sure there's a, you know, a convening group in your city to make sure the mayor understands this issue is extremely important. And there are lots of resources I'd be happy to point the mayor to that would help in this political battle.
And have you done that with the mayor of Cambridge?
I am in the process. I just got here a week ago.
Oh,
I met
okay.
with him before. What we're going to do, I think, is a regional direction here with Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, Worcester, and Springfield all acting at once. Because, again, this is a political problem, and you don't want any one mayor to get isolated. And you want the senators involved, too. So Markey and Warren, everybody standing up at the same moment saying, here's our request for proposal for this dark fiber network. Got to answer in 90 days. Mm-hmm. And then just move ahead after that.
Thanks, Candy, for the call. Paul in Illinois. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a few points. I'll try to keep them brief. I actually emailed first and decided that this gets my goat enough to call.
Okay.
I'm near Grays Lake, Illinois. I moved in, I don't know, 13 years ago. At that point, I had no choices. That was despite Illinois having provided very significant incentives, tax breaks, and the like to the telephone carrier in the state, the major one, to provide, I forget the exact term, quote-unquote, universal access or like, basically high-speed internet access to all. They took the money, they turned around and started spending it on lobbyists to keep the money but get out of their half of that agreement. Eventually, Comcast Internet came, and I took that. In the past 6 or so years, my cost for that, once the initial promo period was over, went from a little under $60 to, in my most recent bill, $97.
Ooh.
I have not called them up once to change my service. I basically have what I had before. Maybe they increased the speed a bit, but that's how much my cost has gone up. As far as the feasibility of doing this and the ability to roll out these types of higher speed networks, I have read numerous stories, a number in the Midwest, where eventually municipalities have thrown up their hands, said, you know, the incumbents are never going to bring this to us. They refuse to. We will issue bonds or go through some similar route and build our own network, and then it will be equal access. Immediately thereupon, AT&T, Comcast, and the like, particularly the phone companies, take these municipalities to court and sue them for unfair competition. And they also spend more lobbying dollars to try and get the state legislatures to outlaw these types of developments. That's what we're up against.
Susan.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. In 19 states, it's either unlawful or very difficult for municipalities to do it for themselves, to build these networks. And the FCC, one thing the FCC could do at this point is preempt all those terrible state laws. But here's the thing, the caller's right. You can think of all of these companies as ATMs with lobbyists on top. They're coining enormous amounts of money, and they have almost unlimited political clout to convince state houses to go their way. So this is why this has to be both a leadership issue, the very top of our hierarchy, the mayors and the president, and also Americans really need to get interested in this and push to elect people who care about high-speed internet access and this, you know, the conditions under which this essential infrastructure is provided. Yeah, prices keep going up, and services don't.
That bill is really high. You can't be making, you know, sort of a let's get by wage, and as so many people are, and pay that kind of money a month for your internet. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, and that's actually low. I mean, Comcast's average revenue per user is up something about $160 a month.
Wow.
So they're making enormous amounts of money because people will give up food before they give up their pay TV and internet access.
Right.
You really can't do anything without it. Another trick of these actors is to only sell the bundle. So very few people actually just get internet access alone, and then they really get attached to programming, and then it's just hard to give up.
Yes. Here is an email from Steve in Madison. Why, if Roosevelt led the charge during the 30s on electrification, why hasn't Obama led the charge on this issue?
Well, Mr. Obama frequently golfs with Brian Roberts, the CEO of Comcast, who made $29 million last year. And these groups really do have a lot of political power. Again, they're big employers in America, and it is Mr. Obama has to choose the battle he's going to take on. And for whatever reason, this one has not been at the top of your list. And you can see that from the debacle that was healthcare.gov, the release of that website. These two issues are tied together. Where technology is not at the policy table and is not taken seriously, it's just not on the radar screen. It's not something that's viewed as essential.
Hmm.
And that's a big policy problem for the country.
Yeah, fascinating. $29 million for the CEO of Comcast.
Yeah.
We take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about net neutrality, which is dead right now, how it became dead and what might change it is what we're talking about this hour with, as you can tell, a very, very knowledgeable guest. And we're welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Susan Crawford is a visiting professor in intellectual property at Harvard Law School. We last had her on talking about cable, and today it's on the Internet. She's the author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. She teaches Internet law, communications law, was one of Time Magazine's Tech 40, the most influential minds in tech. That was last year, and we're referencing, there's a lot on this on the Internet, but she wrote a piece on January 15 titled Why Net Neutrality Matters to You, and that's what we're talking about this hour. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. We are on Facebook on the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well until the costs go up. And that's talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to more phone calls. David is next. Hi, David.
Good afternoon. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good. I got a quick question for your guest, and I'll take my answer off the air. I live in northern Wisconsin. In not too many years ago, we had a product called Free TV. We don't anymore. What's happened to that? And it's all going through satellites. Why is it not free? I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Huh. I don't know about the product, but in fact, the U.S. has a deep commitment to free television in the sense that broadcasters transmit their programming over the air. We made a transition in 2009 to a digital form of those broadcasts, but it's still available. And if you can be near a tower, you can pick it up using rabbit ears. So I don't know about the product. I do know that broadcast TV is still available over the air for free. I also know, though, that the broadcasters are making tons of money by charging cable operators to distribute their programming to the 90% of Americans who get television through the cable box. And they're just asking for more and more money. And, again, consumers are getting squeezed. So I know that's not a satisfying answer, but I don't know about the product you reference.
Let's go to Laura in Madison. Hi.
I just wanted to point out the difficulties on the legislative level. I mean, ever since the Telecommunications Act of 1996, I've seen an attack on any attempt to control the what used to be free airwaves and of course, the Internet. And it's alarming to me. 2 years ago, the state of Wisconsin passed laws to break up WISCNET, which was a cooperative agreement between the UW and the Department of Public Instruction. They received federal funds and had built a very good network to the rural parts of Wisconsin that the commercial enterprises didn't feel were profitable. Well, the legislature said this is too... Well, actually, AT&T said they didn't like this arrangement, and they got the legislature to, without much, even conversation about it, got the legislature to break it up and give the money back to the federal government. I don't think it bodes well.
Yeah, thanks for that story. That was a tragedy. A terrific fiber network that had been in part subsidized by federal funds because infrastructure is part of the function of a state. That was, I don't know if it was broken up, but it wasn't allowed to be successful by the lobbyists, by AT&T and their impact on the Wisconsin state legislature. So, but, AT&T gets a lot done because the legislators themselves don't quite understand these issues. There's a lot of self-deception and a lot of ignorance. So we need a giant education campaign for state legislators, and we may need to make it feel that they will only be reelected if they understand and vote correctly on these kinds of issues. And I would hope that someday in Wisconsin that'll be the case.
Hmm. And let's go back to the FCC again, because you talked about the war that would happen should they fix what they've done, and they do it right away. Is there any chance that they are going to fix this, that they're going to change, that they are going to regulate?
I'm optimistic. There's a chance. They do need to hear from people. They need to know that they have political cover if they decide to do it. And that's why going through free press and public knowledge is the way to make your voices heard on that one.
Okay. John is next in Milwaukee. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you, John?
I'm fine.
Good.
I'll make this very brief. It's a comment and a question. In 2002, I got to Comcast. The service was atrocious, so I dropped them. Skipped a couple of years later, and about 2007, I was at another position where I had to go back to Comcast, and not much changed. And I don't want to, make this all about reviews of who's great, who's not. But, again, it was horrible. The service was bad. They had to come out multiple times. I switched to Verizon and got DSL, which is a little bit slower, granted, but I haven't had a problem since. And I even conveyed my concern to Comcast, and it just seems like they just don't care. They're getting so much money. Why would they really care about one person? So I guess my question is, in addition to – that's kind of a side story or whatever, but why isn't these companies – I know that your guest mentioned that they had Comcast in Cambridge and they don't really have any choices. Why isn't that go up against, any kind of monopoly law or something to that effect where they can just do whatever they please in the area that they control?
Mm-hmm.
And I do appreciate this conversation. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks,
Thank
John. Thank you.
Well, there are a lot of conflicts of interest in this story, and some of these conflicts of interest are at the city level. So in New York City and in Cambridge, the mayor and the city departments get a lot of money from video franchise fees, and often it amounts to 5% of what the video franchise or is making in that town. Now, that's a whole lot of money. In New York City, it's $150 million.
Whoa.
And in Cambridge, I don't know how much money it is, but I do know that the city council and many of the city offices get free service. So even though exclusive franchises have been illegal since 1992, de facto, the city fathers choose the operator that's going to give them the most free stuff.
Mm.
And that's what's happened in Cambridge. So it just is a terrible system, and cities need to decide for themselves that putting in a neutral infrastructure is just like having a tree canopy, just like having a street grid. It's just infrastructure, and it will be much more lucrative for them in the long run to have businesses move in and, people will be able to communicate than to get these short-run revenue kickbacks from the companies themselves.
Mm-hmm. Leah on email wants to know how this will affect rural areas. She writes, "We have an independent internet provider, and we can't get cable where we live. Our internet is too slow to support Apple TV right now, and we have no other choice for internet. Will we lose all access in the future?"
Well, this is what happens when you leave infrastructure to just the private market. Rural areas are systematically left out, and that's happened with high-speed internet access in America. It happened with electricity. And what that does is force a lot of costs onto the state. So the FCC is struggling to find out a way to require universal service. It's called getting internet access to everybody. But it's low quality and very slow and not a very good system. So especially if the FCC doesn't have the authority to do much about this, it's not making a change. For 19 million Americans, they can't buy a wire at any price. It's just not available. So, again, this is an area for real and strong and effective government intervention to require competition where it's possible in the cities and require world-class service in rural areas.
Yeah. Ron is next. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Ron.
Say, I got Dish right now, and I called them. Well, I stopped at one of the places and asked them about the internet because they're offering the internet right now. And I says, well, I could maybe cut down to the $20 package and get internet for $39. I said, I could get television off of that, couldn't I? Well, they tell me, oh, that's too slow. I'm going, well, then what the hell are you offering the high-speed internet for if that's too slow, I mean, they want to get the $120 out of you for the month, I think that's the bottom line. They just want to make the money because the channels they got on, the 120 package, I call them and ask them, It's just like the old song Pink Floyd says, there's 99 channels of stuff on TV to choose
right.
from.
All right, Susan.
Well, so the satellite story is that it's 22,000 miles up and down, and so the services they sell often have very low data caps on them in terms of data, and they're also subject to latency. That it's just a long way up and a long way down to get that data moving around. So only in areas where there is no wire do people usually choose Internet access from a satellite provider. It's not a substitute for what's possible either over cable, much less what's possible over a fiber connection. And a source of great confusion in this conversation that the operators act on is everybody calls everything high-speed Internet access, and not everything is high-speed. And frankly, 2 megabits per second, 4 megabits per second, that's not high-speed. In Stockholm, they're getting gigabit access, which is more than 100 times faster.
My.
That. And we have no hope of getting there absent real policy change.
So thanks very much, Ron, for the call. And by the way, our lines have been jammed. They are open now if you want to join the conversation. Net neutrality is the subject this hour with a great guest. And we're welcoming phone calls for Susan Crawford at 800-486-8655. She's a visiting professor in intellectual property at Harvard Law School, author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. She was special assistant to the president for science, technology, and innovation. She co-led the FCC transition team between the Bush and the Obama administration, and she has taught other places as well. So lines are open. Are you familiar? You talk about Sweden and some of the other countries. Are there places, cities in the United States that have done the right thing and transformed this whole discussion?
Sure, yes. Lafayette, Louisiana, and Chattanooga, Tennessee, both run by Republican mayors. I decided that they're just fed up with how bad things were, and so they actually used their electric utilities to build their own system. So Chattanooga, you can get gigabit access for $70 a month, and they're seeing new businesses move there. They're very excited about that.
Hmm.
Kansas City has taken in Google, which is going to be selling fiber to the home also for $70 a month. I'm a little worried about private companies doing this because then you're just swapping one monopoly for the other.
Mm-hmm.
But at least we're going to get the use case, a demonstration of how different it could be if you could assume very high speed, inexpensive connectivity, all the new ideas and new jobs and new ways of making a living that are generated by having that capacity in place, just as, you know, having electricity changed what America was able to do. Same thing here.
Yeah. Teresa in Tomahawk, hello.
Hi. Great for taking my call. I've just picked up the last 15 minutes. I've traveled all over the world. I live in northern Wisconsin. I don't understand why Europe, why Asia, even the children of Rwanda have better high-speed internet cellular service than we do in the U.S.
Yep, it's mostly because of policy. So there on the streets of Stockholm, streets of South Korea, you can get very high-speed mobile service, and that's because all of those guys also use fiber. The deeper you can get that fiber into the network, the better your mobile communications are. I can't complete a call in New York City. They drop all the time.
Mm.
And people in Stockholm looked at me and said, what are you guys doing? I mean, I can't read a Swedish newspaper from Central Park. I can read it from Johannesburg. What's your problem? So this is all policy. It's not magic. It's because we deregulated the sector and gave up on driving ourselves into the 21st century when it comes to communications.
Hmm. Thanks, Teresa. Jared in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I had a real quick question. You know, you brought up the issue with monopoly and how that can lay the things. My question is, with the telecommunication industry, just their practices, you know, it seems to me like, you know, competition is supposed to drive excellence in service providers. Yet if everybody employs the same, you know, real stinky techniques of sleazy salesmen or, I mean, I'm not making accusations, but I'm saying, should that be the case where everybody's exercising the same policies that aren't good? At what point in time do you recognize the industry is being faulted and not the absence of a monopoly being the issue?
Right. Well, that's fascinating. It turns out that where consolidation is possible, competition is impossible. So these guys have very rationally divided markets. They've got a physical division for the cable guys. They never enter each other's territories. And then wireless is a separate marketplace where Verizon and AT&T are standing mostly. And that's just rational from their standpoint. So, you know, I don't want to say they're evil or malign. They're just doing business. But this is the kind of business that's so fundamental. It's like turning our highways over to a few private companies, that we cannot let it sit this way, and we have to take it seriously as a policy issue.
Susan, thank you so much for being with us. You're always so informative, and you make so much sense. And I thank you for being with us again.
Well, thank you so much, Kathleen, and thanks to your callers. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, our pleasure. Susan Crawford, our guest this hour. Her book, again, is Captive Audience, the Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. But the piece that is very pertinent to what we were talking about today because of last week's U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. area handling down a decision regarding net neutrality. Her piece, op-ed in Newsday, Why Net Neutrality Matters to You. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and for on-air production as well here in downtown Milwaukee. We have a fascinating hour coming up, so stay with us.